From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of the greatest players in basketball history, Julius Erving. In his 16 years in the pros, Dr. J racked up more than 30,000 points and moved the game of basketball into the air. Also today, we meet All Things Considered host Robert Siegel. He's edited a new book of NPR interviews. And world music commentator Milo Miles reviews Nawa music from Morocco. Jimmy Page and Robert Plant gave their listeners a taste of it in their recent MTV performance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With his jumps and slam dunks, Julius Erving moved the sport of basketball into the air. He was such a graceful player that Temple University gave him an honorary degree in dance. Dr. J was not only beautiful to watch, he was the consummate role model. When he retired in 1987, sports writer Frank DeFord wrote, "Of all the people who have played games in the 20th century, perhaps two or three have been nicer human beings than Julius Erving." Erving started his pro career with the American Basketball Association, where he was widely considered the greatest player in the league. When the ABA folded in 76, Erving joined the Philadelphia 76ers, where he played until he retired in 87. In his retirement, Erving became a businessman. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 93. Now he's written the foreword to a new edition of the official NBA Basketball Encyclopedia. I asked him how he developed his acrobatic style in the air.
I think that just evolved. I was always an aggressive player, particularly in high school. As a matter of fact, many of my friends and my teammates used to say that I was wild because I would really attack the basket, and I would attack it for rebounds. I would attack it in trying to protect the basket. If a player came to the basket, I would attack him, and I used to foul a lot, but. You know, the level of play determines certain things. And, you know, when you're young and you're playing at the elementary level, what is a foul there wouldn't necessarily be a foul on the next level or a higher level. And when I went to the basket, if I got hacked by somebody, I mean, I would never call fouls. I would always call guys crybabies who would whine and complain about getting hit. And I said, look, you know, when you go play against the big boys, you're going to get hit like that, and they're not going to make the call. So don't make it here. But, you know, that was just my opinion. And as it turned out, you know, my opinion proved to be the truth, because it was very beneficial that, you know, I could play through physical contact and, be a high scoring player. And not a crybaby, because I think, you know, a lot of crybabies, officials look upon crybabies as floppers, guys who are faking it many of the time, and they don't reward them with free throws.
Now, what about learning how to jump? I mean, how to jump real high? Is that something, a gift you naturally had? Is that something you worked at?
Combination of the two. I think I had some innate ability. And once again, my physical build, the physical attributes that I was blessed with by my creator, enabled me to be a pretty good leaper. But it was something that I also worked hard on. I did isometric drills. Mm-hmm. I did different jumping drills. And after learning about the different jumping drills that were available to be done, I always worked to try and perfect the drill, figuring that's where you're going to get the maximum development for your muscles, and you're going to get the maximum in terms of your timing. So much of jumping and jumping high and looking good and being in control when you leave the ground has to do with, first of all, a lack of a fear of landing and landing improperly and getting hurt, and then the timing, jumping at the right time so that you get the maximum out of the jump and you're not, you know, wasting energy. One of the things, I can tell you a little story if you want to listen to it. When I was a kid, probably 8 or 9 years old, I lived in a housing project in Hempstead, New York, out on Long Island. And we lived on the third floor of the apartment building. And when my mom used to send me on errands, whether it was to go to the store and, you know, pick up a loaf of bread or butter or whatever, I used to always see how fast I could do it. And, you know, so I would time myself. And I figured out that, you know, I'd run out the apartment door and I'd go down, you know, three different flights of steps. And then I'd run to the store, which was only about a block and a half away. And then in coming back, you know, I had to run up three flights of steps. And I tried to figure out a way to get up those steps a little more quickly. So I began getting into the habit of leaping up the steps. And I got to the point where, you know, I could jump up three steps, then four, then five, then six, then seven. And then I could jump up, you know, all seven steps to the landing area. And I remember as a kid just challenging myself to do that. And I didn't realize that that was going to come into play later in life in terms of what I was to become professionally. But it just shows one of the mysterious ways in which things turn out.
Julius Erving is my guest if you're just joining us. And he wrote the foreword to the new official NBA basketball encyclopedia. Was your style considered flamboyant when you got to the NBA?
I think from a purist view, there were a lot of purists who didn't like my style of play, and it really didn't become acceptable until we won. And it happened actually before the NBA. I had a five-year career in the ABA, mm-hmm. which is also a part of the Basketball Encyclopedia's history, a league that existed for 9 years and coexisted with the NBA until it was a merger in 1976 of the four remaining teams in the ABA with the NBA teams. And I think about my second year in the ABA, in which I was playing for the Virginia Squires, a defunct team, as they call them. One of the basketball purists, one of the most pure of the basketball purists, a guy named Adolph Rupp, who was a legendary coach of University of Kentucky, saw me play, and you know, I beat the Kentucky Colonels that night with a last-second shot from the top of the key, and he came into the locker room, and he told me personally, he said, you know, I used to always tell my players never leave their feet unless they knew what they were going to do. And, you know, he had watched me play, and I was one of those players who would leave their feet and then create something while I was in the air. And I didn't know what I was going to do all the time. I just knew I was trying to do something positive, and I didn't know whether it was going to be a shot, a pass, or what have you. And, you know, sometimes those plays end up in turnovers, but, you know, one of my slogans was always dare to be great. So he came in, and he said, you know, I always thought when players did things like that, or if they were flashy, flamboyant, or they did things away from the fundamentals, that, you know, that they were losers, you know, but you're a winner. And, you know, it was really a supreme compliment being paid to a very young player by a guy who had been around, who was coming to understand that change isn't always bad,
mm-hmm.
And in this sport, particularly in the last 10 years, we've seen tremendous changes, and we've seen it. You know, we've seen the players adapt physically and otherwise, and we've seen the fans adapt. And the modern era game is really a lot different than it was in the early days.
Well, and you're part of the reason why. I mean, you took the game more into the air than it had ever been before. Did you ever feel like your coach wanted you to tone that down outside of the story that you just told us?
Well, my sophomore year in college, I was at the University of Massachusetts, and Jack Lehman was a basketball coach there, and he's a great friend. And the two kids who were sophomores along with me, both from New Jersey, and this one kid and myself had a little alley-oop play that we had worked on. So we got into a game, and he threw the lob pass over the zone defense, and I caught the ball in the air above the rim, and I just laid it in with a finger roll. And after we scored the basket, our coach called timeout. I mean, he was so upset because it was a non-purist play. It was a glimpse of the future. And, he bawled us out on the sideline. He says, "I don't remember ever designing that play, you know, and what are you guys doing? You guys take that back to New York and New Jersey or get with the program." And we got with the program, but it was the first time that had really felt a resistance to being innovative on the court. And it was a short-lived experience because I think after about another week or two, he came around and just realized that we were down in a couple of games, and our plays weren't being worked to perfection. And he looked at the two of us. He says, "Remember that play you guys ran a few weeks ago? You threw the ball over the defense. You think it could work now?" We said, "Yeah, let's give it a shot." And it became one of our regular plays after that.
Well, I'm wondering if your early years, if you had two different styles of playing, one for playing in the streets and the other for playing on your team in school.
I don't think my style was that different, school versus playground. I got oriented to organized basketball when I was about 9 years old. I think at eight or nine, when I lived in Hempstead, I was introduced to the Salvation Army through their recreation center. And I was playing out in one of the parks, a park called Camel Park, outside of the housing projects where I lived. And a guy came by one day, a guy named Andy Haggerty, who's no longer with us. And he saw me and a lot of other kids playing outside, and there was ice on the ground, and it was December, and he said, "How'd you kids like to go play basketball inside?" And we said, "Sure." So we got permission from our parents, and he took us to a place which was about 3 miles from where we lived, and it was a nice indoor facility. And the Salvation Army ran it, and they had a gym, and they had a chapel, and that was, to me, that gentleman and that experience was a change agent in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the recreation center. I learned how to play organized basketball. So even when I played in the playground, I always played organized basketball, and played with rules, and adhered to. The things that are important to know about playing basketball, playing with teammates, and on offense you're trying to score, on defense you're trying to stop the other team from scoring, all the other things are pretty much extracurricular. How it evolved into, the flamboyant style that I played, I think there were times when I got on the basketball court by myself, and I used to experiment, and I used to just go through a lot of the trial and error process of throwing the ball up on the backboard a lot of different ways and seeing how it would react. It actually was, almost like a geometrical experiment, throwing it up, putting a top spin on it, bottom spin, left, right, and I don't know why I did those things, but I did those mostly by myself, and every now and then in a game, I'd be forced in a position where, I'm attacking the basket, someone gets in the way, and, in order to avoid the contact, you twist or turn, and then, or you leap away from them, and then, throw it up, and because of the angle that you're throwing it up from, you have to put a certain type of spin on it.
Boy, it sounds like you almost had a scientific approach to the game.
I would say some parts of my game were very scientific. And I it might have held me back in some regards, because although I put a lot of time into it, you know, I never wanted to be, I guess, locked into the stereotypical view, you know, of the young black athlete who can only do, you know, one thing, go out and play basketball. So all the while I was trying to perfect my game as a basketball player, I think I was focusing and realistic of the possibilities that I might not have a professional basketball career. And there were other things in life that I should be interested in doing. And
like what?
And that I would have to do, even if I did have a basketball career, because, you know, I was planning on having life after basketball.
What were your fallback schemes?
Well, when I went to UMass, one of the reasons why I chose the University of Massachusetts was because they had a very good business school. And, you know, I studied management and marketing while I was there. And even though I left school after my junior year, I went back and I got my degree in a program they have called the University Without Walls. And, you know, now I view myself as a business entrepreneur involved in the Coca-Cola bottling business, cable TV business, and also wearing a few different hats, such as an analyst for NBC. So I think most of my dreams that I had as a youngster have come true or have the potential to come true.
Mm-hmm. Julius Erving is my guest, and he's written the foreword to a new edition of the official NBA Basketball Encyclopedia. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Julius Erving, and he's just written the foreword to the new edition of the official NBA Basketball Encyclopedia. A lot of young players lose their bearings after becoming professional athletes because of the sudden fame and because of the money. Did that ever come close to happening with you?
I think I don't think there was ever a period in which I was lost. I had to make some decisions, and I realized that these decisions would impact, you know, what people thought of me. By the time I was 23, if you remember that era, the 1970s, early 1970s, the platform shoes and the bell bottoms and the big afros and everything were very much in style and in vogue. And although I gave in to, you know, the peer pressure to wear those clothes, I never felt totally comfortable that I needed to be Dr. J on the court and Dr. J off the court. So I made a decision that I would always introduce myself as Julius, and I would allow people to call me by my nickname and relate to me because of, you know, how I was able to do some things that might bring them out of their seats. But if I went somewhere, I wasn't going to be the life of the party. You know, I wasn't going to position myself to be the center of attention. That just wasn't my personality. I think I was a little more serious-minded. As a matter of fact, sometimes accused by friends and family of being a little too serious at a young age, that I should loosen up and have more fun. But I was having fun, and I was having fun being serious because, you know, once again, the stereotypical image of the day, particularly for the young black athlete, was that, you know, he can't talk well in interviews, and it was all about the things that he can't do outside of playing his sport. And I took that to heart, and I was offended by it, and, you know, had to try and do something about it.
You were always considered quite a role model. Did you ever feel that you were under pressure to be exemplary?
Well, I think once again it boils down to commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no greater pressure than the pressure you put on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I received any pressure from anyone else saying, you know, a manager or an agent or a lawyer or fan or anything saying, well, you got to be like this or you got to do this. I think by being a spiritual person, you know, having a role model like Christ and, you know, having models here on earth who were high achievers, it became somewhat dictatorial in terms of what my behavior would be.
I think you were about 30 when you accepted Christ. Did that happen after a turning point in your life?
I think I knew Christ all along, and I think accepting an invitation at that time to ask Christ in my life came... Yeah, it was after a physical setback, but it was also after, you know, being exposed to what I at that time perceived to be the proper route. I mean, I was baptized long before that. I was baptized when I was 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of proclaiming myself as a follower of Christ, that came as a result of being involved with the Pro Basketball Fellowship and, you know, attending Bible studies with teammates and lay people who were working within the league to unite the players and get them more focused on their salvation, you know, versus their salaries. And at that particular time, after, you know, being out there for the first half of my career, I was out there for 8 years at that time, at 29, you know, I decided that that's where I would direct my life.
Did the players, any of your player friends, think you were odd for accepting Christ?
Oh, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. You know, as a matter of fact, half of our team were believers,
mm-hmm.
and the other half weren't. And, you know, we were the models for the other half. I mean, they always looked at us, paid close attention to us. And, you know, we were the team leaders. So we were the ones who were more talented, and we were the team leaders. So, no, they didn't look at us odd. We weren't in the minority.
I'm interested in what you think of the ways in which the game has changed since you retired. Let me ask you first about talking trash on the court. What do you think of that?
I don't see a permanent place for it in the game. And I think it's winding down a little bit. It's you know, it's a double-edged sword. Some of the highlights that you see on, you know, Sports Center and other highlight shows, even on the news, are of incidents that are sometimes less than flattering. You know, guys banging chests and talking trash and getting in one another's faces after, you know, certain spectacular or so-called spectacular plays are made, as if it's never been done before. And, you know, I mean, there were times when, you know, guys during my era or even before my era, you know, would play, make a play like that, and, you know, he'd just run down the court and play defense. And, you know, now you see a guy tipping the ball and he raises his fist and he runs, you know, by the cheerleaders and high fives all of them. And, you know, the other team's taking the ball in, his man's beating him down the court, and by the time he gets down there and gets settled from all the celebration, you know, the coach is upset. And personally, you know, I don't see it being productive. I see Madison Avenue liking some aspects of you know, the highlights and the different things that go along with it, you know, the chest banging, different colored hair. What else do you have out there? I mean, you got a few characters who are crying out because they want to be different. And it's going to boil down to ultimately skill and talent and commitment being the difference, as, you know, can be attested to by the Houston Rockets winning the championship. You know, they weren't the team that was, you know, out there banging chests. They weren't the team that was out there doing eccentric things. They were the team that played the game straight and, you know, had guys, had a leader, you know, who was a spiritual guy and who was a great, great human being, as well as a great, great basketball player. And he led the way, and they followed his example. And that's how the story is going to end up most years.
Julius Erving, he wrote the foreword to the new NBA Basketball Encyclopedia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has been part of National Public Radio for much of its history. He's also shaped much of NPR's history as its first London bureau chief, its news director, and now as a host of All Things Considered. Coming up, a conversation with Robert Siegel. He's edited a new book of NPR interviews. Also, world music commentator Milo Miles introduces us to the latest export from Morocco, Nawa music. Robert Plant and Jimmy Page played with a Nawa ensemble on their MTV Unleaded performance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As co-host of All Things Considered, Robert Siegel brings the evening news to millions of NPR listeners. He's just the guy you want to get your news from. He knows everything, or at least seems to. He's always fair, never a sucker, and he's funny, too. He's unshakable, whether he's live on the air as a war breaks out or conducting an interview on the mating habits of elephants. Siegel helped shape NPR's news operation. Since joining NPR in 1976 as an associate producer, he's been an editor, the network's first London bureau chief, and news director. As a host of All Things Considered, he's reported from hotspots around the world. He's also interviewed many authors on book tours. Now, he's an author on book tour. He's edited a new book called The NPR Interviews 1994, collecting the best interviews from last year. Last week, I spoke with Robert Siegel before an audience of WHYY listeners in Philadelphia. We have an excerpt of that interview for you. Take us behind the scenes at an editorial meeting. What are some of the typical things that you argue about in an editorial meeting? Ethical things, journalistic standards, or whether, you know, how a story should be covered, if it should be covered. Maybe you could talk about a recent meeting when there was a lot of disagreement over a story.
Well, that's a little bit. Since those disagreements can be pretty intense, I'm trying to edit in my mind very rapidly which ones are for public consumption. The first typical question is: Should we cover anything? Should we cover the story at all? Is it worth our paying attention to it? The hardest kind of story for us to deal with in that sense would be, say, the O.J. Simpson trial, where there is an impulse at a place like NPR to say, let's not get in this muck. Let's stay away from this. It's a murder trial. Let's not do it. I was one of those at our meeting who said, we're reaching a dangerous point here because Totenberg and I were just talking, and we're both reading the Washington Post story start to finish about the Simpson case, and people talk about it, and everywhere we go, people are mumbling about and we haven't mentioned it on the air, and we can't reach a point where things that are very much on people's minds and that might be sorted out by a good reporter are not appearing at all on our air because we think they're not for us. Well, that's an arguable question. And then, of course, comes the next question. Should we devote every single day to the O.J. Simpson trial, which is what some outfits seem to have done? In that case, I actually came to the conclusion, having heard a lot of talk show conspiracy theories, that we owe it to people to provide some simple, straight reporting. Because if not, it simply becomes a a playground for loony, paranoid theories of what the trial is about. So that's an argument.
Right, but you have a voice that I think some people would consider, you know, a real radio voice. You know, you have a deep voice. You have well-rounded tones. Do you know what I mean? It's
No one's ever mentioned this. No,
No, but
I know what you mean. Yeah.
I mean, some of us have voices that we're surprised we're on radio. And I mean, your voice was, you could say, made for radio. Did that help steer you toward radio? Did your voice have anything to do with your interest in radio?
It did, in the sense that people told me when I was entering college, you should go to the radio station. You sound like you'd sound good on the radio station. And then it got me past an audition to be on the radio, I guess. And that
you
was it.
Had to audition, right?
That was it. That's the last thing I learned how to do in my life. but it's not. People sometimes ask me, "Did you do work on your voice, or did you?" You know, I don't know what that means actually, but I didn't. Whatever it is,
I know what that means.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you know what it means.
Well, what it means is, for instance, you could talk really stilted when you're reading, and really need to learn how to read like you're speaking to somebody.
Yeah. I haven't done that.
Yeah, well, you don't need to. You know, did your voice have? You probably wanted to go into journalism, anyways, right?
Actually, not. I mean, actually, I became bitten by radio.
After you went there because people told you you had a good voice?
I went there because they told me I should work at the radio station. I loved doing radio.
This was at Columbia University.
This was at Columbia College, Columbia University, and I would do newscasts, but I would be a golden oldies disc jockey, and I would announce classical music, and I just loved radio. And I was always doing news, and that was at least the activity that redeemed the other activities, made the others seem somewhat plausible that I should be wasting all this time at the radio station. And then at the end of college, I was doing news at the radio station, and the Columbia demonstrations, the big anti-war, anti-gym demonstrations they were really, of 1968 took place. And we covered them round the clock, and I anchored the coverage. And
did you sleep at the radio station overnight?
Yeah,
sometimes?
I slept at the radio. When we slept at the radio station. And I loved it. I was absolutely bitten by it. But I hadn't entered wanting to be a journalist.
I bet that was an interesting education in a way, because maybe it was different in New York, which has, the New York Times and the Village Voice. Where I went to school in Buffalo, we all felt when we were students, when there were demonstrations on campus, that the press always got it wrong. Their numbers were off. Their motivation was completely distorted. Was it an education for you to witnessed what happened and then read what the press had to say about it?
It was a very extensive education. First was the experience of saying something on the radio, and then an hour later seeing it come over on our one ticker, a now obsolete machine from the Associated Press, and then hearing our newscasters read it as though it was now news, when after 30 seconds of analysis, this was what we had just said. It's now been disseminated by the Associated Press. The Columbia demonstrations were interesting also because first it showed me that when you live in a community, as I did in this university community, there's some things that were news and different. Like there were hundreds of students occupying buildings, and there was a threat of arrest, and they were about to be arrested by the police. And then there were things that were absolutely normal, like there were radical mime troops around the campus, or people wearing bizarre clothes, or posters. That was normal. And as the television people would arrive, they thought all that was part of the news story. they had difficulty distinguishing between what was unusual and what was everyday. And I realized that there are things you understand about a story by living in it and by being part of it, and then translating it to people. You're either talking to people who are part of it or talking to other people. The big lesson for journalism was the night that I think 700 some people were arrested at Columbia, in what was to be regarded as a disastrous evening for the New York City Police Department, a loss of control, and many people were beaten. Some of them I saw being beaten. And the New York Times went to bed early and published a lead that said that you know, hundreds of students were peaceably evicted from Columbia University's Hamilton Hall, which was actually true. But then the other events that had happened after the Times went to bed were never quite reported or made it into the very bottom graphs of later editions. And for a couple of years, I saw people who actually were pretty sensible human beings trying to say that there had been this mass indiscipline by the police, only to have the New York Times held up to them to say it didn't happen. Many young stringers for the New York Times and even young staff reporters threatened to quit over the over the coverage of that event. But I remember David Suss. Remember David Susskind?
Of course.
I remember David Susskind show where someone was trying to explain that there had been police brutality at Columbia, and he held up the New York Times, and there it was. And the power of the press of record, people who establish the official version of events, to form people's opinions or to help them rationalize their opinions is enormous. And it made a deep impression on me.
Did you go to journalism school, or did you learn on the job by doing?
I went to the job, then I came back to journalism school. And
is that helpful?
Notorious dropout from the Graduate School of Journalism.
Not that helpful.
Well, it's helpful in some way. I met a wonderful man who was a mentor to me, the late John Patterson, who had been a great radio editor at CBS for many years, and a man who actually had lost his legs in the war in a troop train accident, and was a marvelous stoic Virginian from the Shenandoah Valley who could move enormous newsroom tables with one hand and a cane. But I also found it not what I'd become accustomed to in the way of university education. I thought it was a lot of it was awfully anecdotal, and I also just wasn't much of a student.
We're featuring an interview with Robert Siegel, recorded last week before an audience of WHYY listeners in Philadelphia. Siegel is the editor of the new book, The NPR Interviews, 1994. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Last week, I spoke with Robert Siegel, co-host of All Things Considered, before an audience of WHYY listeners in Philadelphia. One of the listeners asked Robert this question. If he could interview any public figure today, who would it be and why?
Instantly, when you say public figure, I think about which leading politician I might want to interview. And those are so often the hardest and worst interviews that we do, that they're, I find them not attractive events. Most politicians I find are off on their own answers, and they have their agenda, and it doesn't matter what I say to them or what Linda or Noah says to them. They'll give the. Was I just saying? I can't remember what I've said and what place now. But was I saying this
Book-tour-itis.
To Marty? It is book Marty Moskowitz. And did I mention Linda Wertheimer's proposal the other day after each of us had recently done a prominent public figure who would have given the same answers if we had, regardless of what we'd said. And she said, I think in the future, Rob, I think we ought to ask these people, we should just say, have you seen the new exhibit at the East Wing of the National Gallery? Because just the same, they're going to say, the president has heard the message of the electorate. And then we should just come back and say, and what about the Redskins? Do you think they have a chance of doing that? And they'll still say, he's a man of the center. He began as a man of a man. So there are some interviews where, to be realistic about this, we're just not, we're furniture, frankly, in some of these interviews. And it's not a great ambition, public figures. There are some writers. This year I got to interview V.S. Naipaul, the novelist, who may not mean much to a lot of people, but it was a big experience for me to talk to him. It was in the sense of talking to a star. It ranked right up there with interviewing Stan Musial the other day this year for me. The somewhat talented harmonica playing Hall of Fame baseball player. Those to me are more satisfying interviews. And I guess if I could if I could get an interview with the Pope, I would find that pretty interesting. In particular, having done some reporting from his hometown, and having been aware of what I think is one of the central roles of the past 15 years of history that we've experienced that he's played.
Robert Siegel, co-host of All Things Considered, recorded at the WHYY studios. The event was produced by Art Ellis. Audrey Bentham was the recording engineer. Robert Siegel has edited a new book called The NPR Interviews, 1994. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the NATO airstrike against the Serbs?
Terry, we've sent Tom Jelton to the former Yugoslavia, and he will have a report on what is going on there. Anne Garrels is in Russia and will be reporting on the anniversary of the nuclear accident at Chernobyl. On American politics, we're going to ask some kids what they think about school prayer. The Republican governors, as you know, are meeting, and we'll have a report on the lobbyists who are hovering around the fringes of that meeting, hoping to make new friends. Also, Roger Tory Peterson on being a bird painter. And we have a new Generation X commentary on the city life of dogs.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. World music commentator Milo Miles says he has no idea why certain styles of world music suddenly seem to be everywhere with lots of new releases, but it happens. Right now, the hot discovery is Nawa music from Morocco. Nawa began as music performed by black slaves brought to Morocco from West Africa in the 16th century. Today it flourishes as a popular music used for healing and meditation in all-night ceremonies. As Milo notes, two members of the rock band Led Zeppelin are among current performers who have added to the mix without shaking the Nawa foundations.
You have heard a kind of Nawa music if you are among the trazillion people who watch Jimmy Page and Robert Plant's unleaded performances on MTV, or have heard the cut City Don't Cry on their No Quarter CD. Overpriced little bit of thievery it is. Page and Plant's accompaniment for that number is very folky, very stark, which is a tip-off to one of the oddities of Nawa. At first, it doesn't seem like there's enough to it. The centerpiece of Nawa is a remarkable instrument called a gimbri, or sometimes sintir. The gimbri is described as a three-string bass or lute, but that doesn't get it. The strings are plucked for both drones and solos, the body of the gimbri is thumped for extra beats, and the neck includes a resonator that buzzes along with the strings. The sound is penetrating, varied, unmistakable. The rest of a basic Nawa group is a bunch of folks who sing call and response with the gimbri player and either clap their hands or metal castanets. Outdoor shows add a few drums, and that's it. ¶¶
Sabina.
In my limited experience, the most soulful Nawa singer and hypnotic Gimbri player is Malim Mahmoud Gahanian. He has his first American release out, produced by Bill Laswell and featuring veteran avant jazz saxophonist Pharoah Sanders. It's called The Trance of Seven Colors, and while it does not include the dreamiest Mahmoud Gahanian performances I have heard, these are recorded with the finest detail and clearest sound balance. Mahmoud Gahanian has an import CD under his own name, which is highly endorsed as an example of pure Nawa, straight up. Impure Nawa, on the other hand, belongs to an expatriate Moroccan who lives in New York named Hassan Hakmoun. Hakmoun comes off as a grand zany, eager for every experiment to stretch the boundaries of Nawa. He's particularly fond of loud electric guitars, hip-hop rhythms, and rap cadences. Needless to say, he's hit his share of dead ends. But after years of dedicated tinkering, he's come up with an album called, yes, Trance, that is consistently wiggly and wild and not for dancers who are faint of foot. Nawa purists are no doubt horrified by Hakmoun's latest, but it's not simply tossed salad and scrambled eggs. Hakmoun has stitched together a deep internal structure to the fusions on Trance, and after a few passes, you will be in the Nawa.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He writes about music for the Boston Globe and the New York Times. Here's more Nawa music from Malim Mahmoud Gahanian. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our director, Roberta Shurrock, is on vacation. Fresh Air's first director, Chris Bergen, is back in the hot seat today. Any flaws in today's program were his fault. I'm Jerry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.